While writing his sprawling first novel, Prague, Arthur Phillips had moments when he thought he'd never finish the book. So his advice for writers is to just keep writing.
Eventually, if everything goes right and you have a lot of luck on top of a lot of success, people will want to turn the page and see what happens. But that urge on their part, I think, follows directly from the urge on your part to say, let's find out what happens tomorrow. You know, I didn't finish a book today, but I didn't have to. All I had to do today was sit down and see what happened.
Prague won a Los Angeles Times Best First Novel Award in 2003, and Arthur Phillips followed it with several more novels. Now his fiction can be read in over 24 languages. After the publication of his fifth novel, The Tragedy of Arthur, Phillips visited the Kansas City Public Library as part of the 2011 Writers at Work series to talk about his fiction, in particular, this faux memoir that contains a previously undiscovered Shakespeare play. Now Arthur Phillips shares more than just a birthday with the Bard. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air, produced at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and here's Arthur Phillips reading from the memoir part of that novel, The Tragedy of Arthur.
Memoirists are self-selected. They want to tell their stories, nice or nasty. I'm something else. A gun to my head, as you will see. I spill my forced confession, revealing me as an indifferent person, a poor friend, a variable brother and son, jealous, hurtful, able to delude myself. I say this not from any pride. It's going to get worse. Still, I acknowledge that I am growing addicted to the pleasures of self-revelation that I once scorned. A memoir requires a courage that we can fairly assert that Shakespeare lacked. What? Squeals the wild-eyed bard lover. Did he never use material from his own life? Did he not reveal himself in his works? A million words over 25 years. Yes, it's very likely that he did secrete dollops of oily autobiography into his crisp fictions. But the existence of such revelations does not mean, especially 400 years later, that you can sift them from the fantasies and the fears and the imagined selves, not to mention his masked revelations about other people you don't know, his friends, his family, enemies.
That's just a little bit of The Tragedy of Arthur by Arthur Phillips. I'm Angela Elam, and I'm in the Kansas City Public Library.
Before a crowd of 10,000. controlled, calm 10,000, but still.
Can you tell us how you got started playing with this idea of memoir?
The memoir idea started because of a certain frustration with memoirs lately. Some of you may have noticed that the label memoir, which is very popular and sells a lot of books, and the label fiction, which is less popular and doesn't sell nearly as many books, doesn't seem to me to define two different kinds of writing. There have been a lot of memoirs lately that are not what you would call factual. And the usual excuse is by the memoirist, well, you know, it's factual to me. That's how I remember it. I think I speak to a higher truth in the way I see it. But I do think actually there is a difference between what you remember and what happened. So that was something that I was interested in playing with a little bit in this book.
I guess we should describe how the book is put together. There is a newly discovered play of Shakespeare that is the last fourth of the book.
It's put in the back so that if you don't want to read Shakespeare, you don't have to. That was the idea. We don't want to put anybody off.
Well, I'm curious, did you write the Shakespearean play first and then write the novel, or how did you go about structuring this?
The short answer is that I would work on the play for a draft and then work on the framing story for a draft and then go back to the play and back to the story and back and forth in that order. So, you know, as these things take 8, 10, 12, 15 drafts, it was always play first, framing story second.
Well, one of the tropes that's going on in the book is that Arthur Phillips' father and his twin sister absolutely love Shakespeare, and he does not share that love of Shakespeare. And yet Arthur Phillips, the novelist, which is confusing because Arthur Phillips within the book is also a novelist.
Sorry, which one am I again?
Arthur Phillips, the one who actually wrote this tragedy.
Yes.
It's so fascinating because somebody who would write this book obviously has to love Shakespeare.
I fell in love with Shakespeare much more profoundly writing the book than I was when I started. I was, like a lot of people, I'm sure, force-fed some Shakespeare over the years in school and college by well-meaning adults. You know, and then it sets into the point where you feel like you can't say, I don't like it. So you invite your date to a Shakespeare play and you nod sagely. It's part of being a basically well-educated person in the United States. You're supposed to like Shakespeare and you're supposed to know something about it. And beyond that, you're not required to go much further. And that's where I stood when I started the book. It was in the process of writing the book that I really would promote him now to one of my favorite writers.
I thought I might have you read a section of this to give a sense of some of the characters and some of your writing, too.
So there is the play at the end of the novel, and the novel is set up as an explanation of why it is that I, Arthur Phillips, am the only owner of the only copy of the long-lost Shakespeare play, and how it is that I brought it to be published, and whether or not it is what it purports to be, an authentic Shakespeare play or something else, which requires a great deal of discussion of my life and childhood. And so the twin question comes up. I have a twin sister. At least for the 300 pages of this book, I have a twin sister. Her name is Dana. We literally were never away from each other for more than a few minutes until we had our own friends in third or fourth grade. And even then, me playing baseball in some boy's yard, her playing dolls in some girl's rec room, there was a feeling that the separate time was in some way a research project for the other. I was experiencing baseball for her. Even if, practicing with a team after school, I wasn't literally thinking of Dana, I was somehow gathering everything in to give to her. The weather, the plays, the feeling of a badly hit ball stinging my arms, the homoerotic towel whippery of the locker room. Even if I didn't end up telling her everything or anything, I stored it for her, I lived it for her, and she knew it was all there if she wanted to ask. I used to think of us as essentially identical, if physically dissimilar. There was something beneath the surface that matched more closely than other people ever felt. Not everyone could see it, but for some, we were literally interchangeable. I recall when we were very young, an old woman in a beauty parlor asking us over and over again, "And tell me again, which one are you, dear?" And my mother smiling at what she took to be the lady's joke about obviously unidentical twins, but I saw the old woman's sincere confusion. "Dana," I answered, lunging at the rare opportunity, and the lady nodded. She peered at me to find some distinguishing mark that she could pin in her memory as Dana. And Dana and I searched the beauty parlor's mirrors together next to each other and then looked at each other, seeing plainly that whatever it was, you couldn't see it. She cried when she learned of Shakespeare's own twin children, the brother dying young, the sister living on. "If something happened to you, I'd be alone forever," she told me. A sweet and dreadful idea, but it leads to problems if nobody dies. If you're alive only when you're with the other, what remains for, say, a wife? Shakespeare's work teems with twins, perfectly identical twins who don't know of each other's existence, fraternal twins identically lovable despite different genders, separated twins in the employ of other separated twins. And it was through twins, Twelfth Night and the Comedy of Errors, that Dana fell for Shakespeare. And there she is on my father's lap, the fat collected works open on her own lap, both of them laughing about some Dromio or other, cheek to cheek and assigning each other parts, while I arranged blue plastic knights and archers on the black pentagons and white hexagons of the kitchen floor tiles, a monochromatic Agincourt battle raging on a flattened soccer ball. My father looked down at me, and he recited from memory the famous Band of Brothers battle speech from Henry V. I listened until those odd words, "Crispin Crispian," reminded me of a breakfast cereal. And hungry, I wandered across the room looking for food, and Dana and Dad held off the French assault without me. I admit, this seems a long way from an introduction to a newly discovered Shakespeare play. This essay is fast becoming an example of that most dismal genre, the memoir. All I can say is that the truth of the play requires understanding the truth of my life. That said, with the best of intentions, still I fall prey to the distortions of memoir writing. The memoir business has lately been an uneasy, under-regulated one, full of inflated claims and frenzied internet debunkers, too many exciting drug addictions and Holocaust misadventures, too much delirious abuse. But even when one is trying to tell the truth, there is no guarantee to accuracy. I realize I have completely misportrayed my youth already, because retrospective importance to me doesn't necessarily jibe with what actually happened to everyone else. My strongest memories, my sensations of meaning and significance are all attached to the parent that I saw less. The mathematical realities of his incarceration and divorce dictate that the vast, vast majority of my youth occurred under the eye of my mother and her second husband, but it is my father, Arthur Edward Harold Phillips, who continually shoves his way to the foreground wherever I turn my memory's camera. In other words, this memoir is, despite my best efforts, already misleading.
That's from near the start of the novel, The Tragedy of Arthur, and I'm talking today with Arthur Phillips at the Kansas City Public Library, and this is New Letters on the Air, and he is weaving in this faux memoir with this Shakespearean play. I read somewhere that you made up some lines of Shakespeare in Angelica, one of your earlier novels. Is that really what propelled you to start thinking about, can I write a Shakespearean drama?
There's a plot point in Angelica. A bunch of actors are speaking in code, and the code they use is they only speak in Shakespearean lines, and so I needed them to talk about certain events in the book, and I couldn't find the Shakespearean lines that I needed. So I thought, well, maybe I'll just write one. And I assumed that people would laugh at me or point out how ridiculous it was, but fortunately, nobody bought or read Angelica, so I was saved from that mockery. It really worked out great. You know, nobody did notice, and it got under my skin at that point, and as I was writing the book after Angelica, the song is You, the thought kept coming back to me, I wonder if I could put together a whole play. What would it require, and how did he put them together, and what would I have to master, and what would I have to research, and what would I have to learn? And at the end of that process, how bad could it be? If it's bad, then I'll write a book about a bad Shakespeare fake, and if it's passable, then I'll write a book about a passable Shakespeare fake.
Thinking about the writing process, when young writers start out, they will often try to write in the style of a particular writer, and you learn a lot by doing that. And I wondered if you as a writer, not that you're a young writer, this is your fifth novel, but I wondered what else you learned besides getting some insight into how his mind worked as a writer who is 400 and something years older than you.
That's an important caveat. When you start to try to imagine what somebody was doing 400 and some years ago, you have to acknowledge that you're projecting and that whatever you know about them factually or biographically is going to be a great distance from you. So having said that, the process of trying to imagine how he would have written the play that's in the back of this book, the process of trying to imagine what his life looked like and felt like, was a profound and wonderful experience. It's unavoidable that you project. And it's unavoidable, therefore, that as I spend a lot of time on this project, I imagine Shakespeare is not terribly unlike me. He's a guy who makes things up for a living, and he's a guy who does little research, and then he goes and he sits and writes, but he's got to get it done on time because he needs the money. And he's got some problems with the tax people, as I do, and he's got to pay for real estate, as I do, and he's got kids to support, as I do, and he's got people that he collaborates with, as I do. And after a while, you start to feel like, oh, I know that guy. That's not a god. That's a writer. And that was really exciting. So to sit down every day and take out my quill and to go out and try to think, okay, what would he have done? What play would he have written? How would he have written it? What would his source material have been? What would his available vocabulary have been? When would he have stretched out and imagined a character or a scene? To think about those things was tremendously moving. And it opened up the rest of his works to me in a way that I hadn't felt when I was forced to read them in school or when my dad said, you know, that's the best stuff that's ever been written, as he does from time to time.
Well, one of the main characters, as you just alluded to in that reading, is the father, Arthur Phillips, who is an amazing con man. Talk a little bit about how you came up with him, because you yourself did not have a con man for a father.
Yes, my real father, a nice conservative lawyer from Minneapolis who wears bow ties still and describes himself as dressing like Herbert Hoover, was a little bit worried reading an early draft of this that people would think my father was in fact a con man imprisoned for most of my childhood.
And lawyers might worry about exactly. That kind of thing.
I told him to calm down and stop whining. The character, on the one hand, he's a fantasy of a father. He takes his kids out to make crop circles early in the book as an adventure. He's sort of what you want your dad to be, the guy who's going to say, I've got another great idea. Let's go do this now. On the other hand, he's gone for a long time because he's imprisoned, counterfeiting this and that and getting caught for it. But his defining feature is he feels the world has gotten a little bit too rational and a little bit too scientific and a little bit too skeptical, and we've lost out on amazement. And one of the reasons that he loves Shakespeare so much is that he is the playwright of people who are amazed, of people who are wondering what's going on. Why are these fairies messing with my love life? Has anyone ever seen a woman as beautiful as that woman? What an amazing moment to be part of. And for him, the wonder of Shakespeare and the wonder of Cannes are very closely intertwined.
One of the really magical scenes is when the father takes them out into that field. And so I'll get you to read this section.
Okay. He seemed to know where he was going. Around a grove of trees, along a path next to a field of corn stalks as high as my 10-year-old waist. From here, step only where I step. Put your feet in my footprints. We have to start in the middle. This was positively exalting, the opposite of daily life. Our father at his best when we were at the age, 10, most receptive to his power. And we did it. It was work, but it felt like something else, something higher. We laid the guide strings, dragged that board on ropes, did the cutting, spread the material, brushed over the wheel tracks and the footprints, restapled the cut wire fence, swept our tire tracks all the way down to the road. All of this probably took 6 or 7 hours in the middle of the night. And the three of us stank of the material. On the ride home, Dane and I slept, despite our questions and bewilderment. I don't remember going upstairs to his apartment or how I woke clean in my pajamas with my cleaned clothes folded next to the air mattress or when the donuts and chocolate milk had arrived. Dane and I both suspected a dream until we saw the other's face, although this didn't definitively settle it since we did still have identical dreams now and again. It was past noon. It seems to me that yet we sleep, we dream, my father said, and Dana climbed onto his lap to hug him. What did we do? She asked. The hard part is still coming, he said. The hard part of magic is letting it happen and not telling anyone. Anyone. You mean Mom, I said, suspicion prickling in me at last. I do mean her, but I'm not so worried about that. I mean anyone, your friends, anyone. Because we can get in trouble, I asked, finally realizing the obvious. Well, yes, I suppose so, the convicted criminal gently granted me only now. But I'm not worried about that either. That's not why the secret is important. Who cares about getting in trouble, Dana said, braver than I, as usual. It's not like we committed a crime, she laughed. I know, I protested. No, here it is. His voice became very serious, and he had our attention. You can't tell anyone because that sucks the life out of what we did. All the fun, all the magic bleeds out, and it's just an empty, stupid thing. But if we don't tell, then we spent last night brilliantly. That's the only difference. You decide, and you make our night what you want, brilliant and ours, or stupid and theirs. And my father made no money from this exploit. He spent a fair amount of money, invested, he would say. The equipment, the time spent researching that site for easy road access, unelectrified fence, good visibility from the air, long distance from the farmer's house, no watchdogs. The time spent in building the machine, adapting a snowblower to cut symmetrical tiered paths through early July corn. The slime he concocted to slather over those paths. And, of course, the fines that he had to pay to that farmer near Worthington, Minnesota, and the community service that he had to perform. And what was his payoff? Why bother? To astonish. To add to the world's store of precious possibility, to set the record crooked once and for all, so that someone's life, some stranger's, was not without wonder. And to this day, the record remains a little crooked, thanks to us. If you Google crop circles, you will find aerial photos of our work, although our circle in 1974 was very basic, not like the overwrought ones they make nowadays. You can find our creation, breathlessly described, and you can read the testimony of some of the first witnesses, neatly detached from any mention of subsequent arrests or human involvement. You'll find descriptions of the alien sludge, now a common occurrence at crop circles, though its actual recipe, my father's invention, remains unpublished as far as I know.
That was wonderful. That's from The Tragedy of Arthur by Arthur Phillips. And you're listening to New Letters on the Air, recorded at the Kansas City Public Library. I think that gives everyone a sense of the charm that the father has that must have been really fun to invent. This novel is so different than the other four that came before, and all four of those are very different too. They all explore such vastly different worlds. Prague, which really has to do with all these people in Budapest, and they play with almost different genres. Angelica is more like a ghost story, and Egyptologist has to do with an adventure story. And then The Song Is You is all about the music world. Is that what you want to do as a writer, is every time find something that's completely different to explore?
I think it's an accident that comes from having a short attention span, more than anything. When you sit down and you know, I'm about to spend 2 years or 3 years or, in some people's cases, 10 years on something, I better hold my attention. Because if it doesn't hold my attention, then it's not going to hold a reader's attention. So the only thing I've set myself out to do when I sit down to start something is to entertain myself and to write a book I'd want to read. As it turns out, sort of accidentally, they're all very different from each other. And people have said,
So it was an accident.
It really is an accident.
Oh,
and so
really?
People have said, so he's the guy who always writes something different. I feel like I'm the guy trying to amuse myself. And then something catches and you feel like, I could really spend 2 years thinking about that one thing. I already love music. I love Shakespeare. I love my own life living in Budapest. I love King Tut. Well, maybe there's a story there somewhere.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you structure your life as a writer. Are you one of these really disciplined people who gets up every morning and writes, or writes late at night? Do you write every day?
Well, first of all, I am so far fortunate enough to be able to write and not have another job, which is a rarity in literature. So I relish that and cherish it, and so I'm trying to protect it. And also, I do love to write, and so I want to make it part of my day. And finally, I have wife and kids and dogs and responsibilities, I guess I'm told. And so those all have to be managed as well. So the answer to your question is yes, I write every weekday on a very set schedule as if it were my actual job, which I guess it is. And I go somewhere and write, somewhere between 2 and 7 hours, depending on where I am in a book.
So when you're in the process of working on one of your novels, what is your favorite part? Is it the actual writing or is it the rewriting?
They all have their own pleasures, actually. And the first lightning strike of, that idea could hold me for a couple years, I remember all five of those. Those are wonderful moments.
So it comes to you kind of
I should clarify. You don't get a whole book in your head. You get a seed. But I think after a while you recognize those seeds as strong enough to grow for 2 years. I used to think writers are people who think of a book and then they write it down. And I think that's probably a pretty common misconception. Books are made by writing them, not by thinking of them first. It is by writing that you figure out what you're going to do next. But those moments of inspiration of, that's the starting point, those are glorious. On the other hand, I like editing, I like rewriting, I like outlining and then throwing away my outline. I like sitting around and surprising myself with something I hadn't thought I was going to write that day.
But you don't always work the same way. I read that you knew the ending of Egyptologist and you worked towards that, but you don't always know the ending to your books.
No, as I was saying, those magical moments of inspiration, in the case of the Egyptologist, it was an ending. And I thought, I've never seen that ending before. That's a great ending. Now I have some hard other stuff to figure out. But I literally thought of what's now the last two pages of that book and thought, that's going to be good. Now how do I get there? But in other cases, it was the beginning. In other cases, it was a small scene in the middle. In this case, it was, I wonder if I could write a Shakespeare play. And then things started to go crazy from there. So it's different every time.
It is pretty amazing, too, because when you see all the footnotes that are involved with the play and working with the Shakespearean language, can sometimes feel like a foreign language almost.
That's how I had to approach it. To be fair to Shakespeare and to encourage people to get back into it, 95% of it is words you know. 5% of it is words you don't know, and what am I up to, 100%? And then another 4% is words put in an order that you're not familiar with. But for the most part, it's fine. But there is a vocabulary problem, and what I discovered to my horror as I got started was there are lots of dictionaries that translate from Elizabethan English to modern English, but there are no dictionaries that translate from modern English to Elizabethan English. So that was a research task I had to set myself first. I wrote about a 20-page dictionary for myself of words I thought I might need. Walk, what were the possibilities that he would have used for walk? One of which was walk, but not as often as you might think. So.
Right. Before I let you go, is there a particular passage of your new novel that you would like to share with us?
Maybe I'd read a little bit of the play, if people are
that. That'd be great.
So you have to have a little background on this play. First of all, it's the tragedy of King Arthur. Secondly, it's not the Arthur story most of us know. It's not Camelot or the Sword in the Stone or Mordred or Lancelot or Merlin. It's very much an argument over succession of who will get to rule Britain in the 500s. And Arthur is the king of the English and the Welsh, and Mordred is the king of the Picts up in northeastern Scotland, and they're fighting for the throne. The other thing you should know is it's purportedly written in the very early 1590s, which means, if you happen to be into Shakespeare, about the time of the Henry VI plays. And for those of you who are really into Shakespeare, that means a couple of other things. One is that the meter, the verse of it, is very regular. He was not yet playing with iambic pentameter in the way he did in his later plays. The other thing that means is that it's not his best work.
Isn't that convenient?
Yes, that was a decision that was made at a certain point. Shall we shoot for 1599 and Henry V and Julius Caesar and 1603 and, you know, a late Hamlet, or should we shoot earlier? Somehow earlier came up. I think I probably rolled a die for that one. All right, on that note, I'll give a little soliloquy. This is the Earl of Cumbria. He's the most military and soldierly of Arthur's noblemen, and he's disgusted that Arthur has been such a shabby king of Britain, and he's considering whether he might want to assassinate King Arthur. This is from Act 3, Scene 3 of the most excellent and tragical history of Arthur, King of Britain, pretty much by William Shakespeare. I want nor crown nor vulgar admiration, and I could in innocence play regicide, as shallow Arthur has too long played king. Come, hand, couldst thou perform this hellish act? But think upon it. In mind's eye perceive the moment when, the start of fear, the cry, the stream of blood, the man betrayed who looks into your eye in want of answers there, the sacrifice of your eternal soul, which you do willing give to devil's clutch, no matter all your right and high intent. But no, I turn and dare not follow this. What affect this? I scarcely know this frost. Is't cowardice, I feel, ice o'er my heart? It is. I see our end, but cannot start. And so do kingdoms fall by vice's art, when righteous men in conscience stand apart.
Well, Arthur, thank you very much for joining us today.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you.
Arthur Phillips, with his novel, The Tragedy of Arthur. He was recorded as part of the 2011 Writers at Work series at the Kansas City Public Library, which has been chosen as the Missouri site for the 2016 Nationwide Folger Tour of the Bard's First Folio. For links to those events, including one involving us as part of the Here Now Festival, as well as to Arthur Phillips' books and the 2015 film Maid of Angelica, visit our website, newletters.org. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial funding from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Annie Walsh, Stephanie Hughes, Dennis Conroe, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.